Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another interview. I have a new guest here, Bazillion Thought, who is somewhat new. Would it be fair to say you're somewhat new?
On this account, for sure. I've been around for maybe 5-ish years. Like, I got radicalized during COVID.
Okay, all right. Well, for me, 5 years is new, but yeah. Certainly, you've come up on my feed for the first time. And I've been trying to get like a sense of where you're coming from. Would it be fair to say that you're coming from the left, slowly drifting over to more dissident spaces? Is that kind of fair?
I still call myself an anti-left Marxist, but definitely when I started, it was the milieu that I was in was more of that post-left sphere that was kind of downstream from Dimes Square and Amy Therese type of thing that kind of all have shifted over to the dissident right.
Right. And I'm, how can I say, almost at the other end of that trajectory where I'm so fed up with them that I've started to drift back.
I absolutely hate everyone around me.
good. You understand what I mean, right? Is that
yes.
I kind of like, I'm fed up of a lot of people.
But a man can only be disappointed for so long.
But also, the left is so awful that you can't really go back to like the woke left. That style of left is just, you know.
I still have a soul and a conscience.
Exactly. So yeah, but I think a lot of people in current year, as we're recording this, are kind of there. So I thought it'd be good to have this conversation. Just before we get going, I have to remind people to buy courses at the Academic Agency. I don't know if promo code SHORJAM will still work when this goes out, but you might as well try it. To try to get 25% off. If it's February, it won't work. It's like a hard coded that the coupon stops working. But just before we get going, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Bazillion Thought. And then also my friend and I, Benny, have started a YouTube show, the Benny Basil Show on YouTube. It's doing great and everyone should check it out.
All right. I'll link that YouTube channel down in the show notes. So you wanted to talk about media market literacy, Twitter as a media market, and a concept that I've heard you talk about when I checked out your show, take sellers. Why don't you give us the kind of the York Notes version of this?
Right. So I think in broad terms, it's basically understanding Twitter as we use it, not as a social media platform to connect with your friends or people you know, but to understand it kind of as a microcosm of the media market, as a kind of pipeline that connects from where we engage with on Twitter to what that connects directly to the more mainstream outlets, CNN, MSNBC in New York, DC, LA, London, where instead of using terms like grifter or influencer, I use the term take seller, right? So what these people, what all of us do, it's a value neutral term. It's not meant to be as negative as something like grifter, but it's what we do is we brand ourselves, we sell our takes in order to direct our audiences to some sort of value extraction, whether it's a Patreon, whether it's a course, whether it's a podcast, whether it's whatever. And I think by understanding Twitter in those terms, you have a better way of more accurately navigating what we're doing here, because that way you start to understand things like patronage, you start to understand things like cartels, you start to understand movements like blackballing and things like that, which are all technically media terms, are all technically entertainment industry terms, but apply here because that's technically what we're doing. We're not doing politics per se. We're doing a kind of parapolitical infotainment.
Yeah, I mean, my phrase for this in the past has been, look, we're not doing politics here. It's not a political movement. What we are is a loosely connected, kind of loosely affiliated group of color commentators, which is a term from pro wrestling, right? But you know, in there's a play-by-play guy who explains what's happening, and then there's a color analyst who kind of gives a flavor description of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of most that the whole YouTube podcast, Twitter, etc. has been. One of the things that I've seen though, as the space has matured, you could say, and you can tell me if you disagree, is that, you know, back in 2016, I think that a lot of things caught the, I mean, we used to call it the mainstream media, by surprise a little bit. 2026 now, and I get the strong feeling that the space is not this kind of, everybody knows what's happening, right? And as a result, the social media space is contested in the same way that the mainstream media space was, and is now being used as a tool to manufacture consensus, to manufacture kind of, you know, so yes, people are selling takes, but on Elon Musk's Twitter, there's a kind of foot on the scales. There's a certain take that they want to be out there, and there are other takes which go against the grain that they don't want to be out there, whatever that happens to be, right? I mean, at the moment, I mean, on any given news story, there'll be a kind of correct line that all your favorite based guys are meant to take. And then if you go against that, I'm always called, you're a contrarian. You're a contrarian, right? I mean, I'm not a contrarian, which is what a contrarian would say. I am simply giving what I think the default view should be. And I think a lot of those other people who are calling me a contrarian are actually pushing a party line. Mm-hmm. That, like, almost as if that party line has come through in a WhatsApp group or in a group chat, and they're all pushing that same line. And that, and that's why someone who goes against it ends up catching flack or whatever else.
Yeah, I use the kind of terminology of a cartel, right? So the same way that you would say this is a party line, I would say that specific cartel has a party line that they've developed in the group chats. And that's basically how it works. I mean, Twitter is not about the timeline per se. The timeline is the equivalent of the bazaar itself, of the market itself. However, where the real sausage is made is, like you said, is in those group chats with specific cartels of take sellers who understand explicitly or implicitly that they are pushing the same line, that their interests are tied together. And I think that there has been a difference from, you know, the 2015, 2016 alt-right days to the present, right? Because I think what we saw in that first iteration of 2015, 2016 alt-right were people who, I think, were more confused in terms of delineation between doing politics and doing entertainment. And they engaged in a way that had a lot of entertainment-type structures, right? So if you're familiar with, like, Barstool Sports, for example, it's an umbrella brand that has many different properties. So if you're a girl, you're listening to Call Her Daddy. If you're a young man, you're, you know, listening to the Delk Boys. You're listening to the main guy. I forget his name. His name escapes me. But they all funnel you back to sports betting and, you know, the main guy. Whereas I think that first iteration of the alt-right kind of had that confusion that led to a lot of missteps and a lot of grief for themselves, which ultimately culminated in Charlottesville, where the whole thing kind of imploded upon itself. And that implosion left a vacuum in the marketplace where we saw, where not only we saw, but more importantly, money interests saw that there was something here that could be used to create, you know, manufacture consent and create consensus. So what you had was a lot of little tech money flowing in the form of, like, Mark Andreessen and Peter Thiel and David Sachs. And what they did was they created a kind of patronage network and vehicle whose ultimate purpose was to get J.D. Vance in the presidency in 2028. And that's that kind of thing, that project is kind of reaching its maturity right now. We're seeing it kind of try to hold itself together to get itself through the finish line at this point where we're like, God, we just need to get Trump out of the way so we can get Vance in. And that's kind of what we're seeing now is that the finalization of that second remix of the market.
Interesting. I mean, there's a lot of things to get into, because one of the things that I've often thought with Trump or with MAGA, let's just call it MAGA, the product at the end of the line is supporting Trump. Okay. But I mean, I don't have the media speak. You're the media guy, right? But I almost see, if you imagine the online space as a media market with different verticals, right? So in, like, if you were in a newsroom, you'd be thinking, oh, how can we hit the 18 to 25s? How can we hit? And Trump space has always had the kook sphere, you're like your Q-tards, your kind of conspiracy, your Alex Joneses, people like that. Then another vertical was the white nationalists. And I do think there was a concerted effort by MAGA at various times to hit that vertical, to dog whistle to them, to message to them. Another vertical was the evangelicals. Another vertical, another vertical is business, right? And they've got a way of trying to hit all those libertarians as a different group, right? The anti-war crowd. These are all different groups. And because Trump is kind of shameless, he will tell each of those groups what they want to hear, despite the fact that making all those promises to all those different people is completely contradictory. It doesn't make any sense. But he will back himself to betray all of those people and still somehow get them back on the reservation next time around. What he does again and again and again. What's happening in this year, I mean, stop me if you disagree. I think at the moment we're seeing that coalition that he built, that he messaged to with segmented marketing to each of those groups, because they all... So the funny thing is, they all basically end up being Q. Okay, what I mean by that is, they end up on a cope on a cope wheel. That is, Trump really does know what he's doing. Just in 2 more weeks' time, the genius of the plan will be revealed. Okay, and all of those groups over time have tended towards that sort of Trumpian logic, right? Regardless of where they are. But what I see happening this year or tail end of last year is that a lot of a lot of people are starting to see through that game now, finally. Tell me if you disagree.
But just in time for people to see through that, there's a brand new wheel, which is, don't worry, guys, Fuhrer Vance is really going to do it this time. Don't worry. We understand Trump has disappointed us in XYZ way, but don't worry. Vance is just here, just like Lucy holding the football for Charlie Brown. She's setting it back up for her to pull it away at the last second when you go to kick it. And it's exactly right. There are all of these different verticals, right? So in the exact same way, the business side is TBPN, right? That teal business forum. You have the trads are the Opus Dei. The white nationalists are the Baptards. All of these things are exactly the same things. All of these exact verticals are exactly, like you said, contradictory to each other. But fundamentally, what they do is to take the white nationalists, for example, because I think it's like the most clear view of how this operates. And you know, it's funny because Nick Land, in talking about Curtis Yarvin, has described it in this way, where they've said that, you know, white nationalism and white nationalists are only dangerous insofar that they are correct about things that other people are not correct about. So what they meant by that is that white nationalists, as defined as, are only dangerous insofar that they are correct about the other things that people are not correct about. Things like, human biodiversity, race and IQ.
Sorry Basil, I have to, because I'm sitting here in Britain, that phrase you use, I'm going to have to bleep it. It's going to be a recurring.
I forgot you were doing a police state. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I will be. Keir Starmer will literally knock on my door, so I have
to. My apologies.
I'll put a bleep, but you know what we talked about, right?
yes. So these people are only dangerous insofar that they have a critique of this thing. So what they do is they try to neutralize them by removing those other things that they're correct about, things like IQ, heritability, these things, and removing that from that critique of this other thing. So that's how come you have people like, Steve Saylor, or you have people like, these kind of kosher versions of human biodiversity or kosher versions of IQ discourse. So it ends up being this thing where all of these verticals have kind of their tentacles. They have their tentacles with each of these verticals, which ultimately for a while has been about supporting Trump no matter what. But I think we're already starting to see is going to be about the ethos being, well, Trump tried his best, but J.D. Vance is really going to do it this time, guys. Trust and believe us.
Now, on Vance, one of the things that interests me is like, all these people, Teal and PayPal Mafia and Little Tech and so on, there's been a lot of Israel criticism in the past year, and lots of fairly mainstream people have engaged in this. So one theory that was doing the rounds that this quote-unquote limited hangout was a setup, basically, to give Vance more leeway on this. Like, Trump is bad on that, but Vance signals that actually he understands, blah, 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 so he's going to be better. How much of that, because that is something that I've not really been able to get a handle on. This is actually something that Fuentes was very vocal about when he was, before he had his interview with Tucker Carlson, he was like, this is what's actually happening. They're trying to sell us Vance and using critiques of Zionism to try to like sell us Vance. Is that really happening? I mean, what's your view on this? Yeah.
Well, the two things that jump out to me in that regard is, I remember right before the airstrikes against Yemen, there were report the single chat leaks, right? Where it was basically, you know, them talking about bombing Yemen and the meme joke of Vance shaking his head the whole time about how much he absolutely hates this. Meanwhile, the train moves along just as scheduled. In the same way, we saw, I believe it was Axios, or maybe it was the Washington Post. One of these outlets reported that, in the same vein with the Iran buildup again, that Vance is saying, oh, no, we can have some sort of negotiation, we can have some sort of diplomacy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's this constant thing where it's like the train keeps moving forward just as scheduled, but the people who need to be given just that little bit amount of hope, that little bit of hopium, are given those little leaks just to be like, no, look, see, when he's in charge, he's going to be different. And it's like, no, the only thing that's going to be different is just going to be more nakedly giving contracts to Palantir and Aaron Dill and keeping crypto markets as liberal as possible, which is fundamentally the top line for little tech. Everything else is fungible except for their own rent seeking through their government contracts and keeping crypto markets as liberal as possible, because that's how they funnel money around the space.
Can I ask a question? This phrase little tech, right? What is the distinction between big tech and little tech? Because, I mean, I look at the Trump admin now, and, I mean, a good example is TikTok, right? Trump basically gifted TikTok to Larry Ellison, who is the number one funder of the IDF, and also the number one funder of Tony Blair Institute. But Oracle is big tech, right? Is that, would that be fair to say?
I think it's about what is size and then what is time. Right, so I think like Google, Facebook, Oracle, those would be big tech, Amazon, and then it's the later in time things like, you know, Palantir, Aaron Dill, it's about the later in time and size. I think because when we think about big tech, we think of like the blue chip, large firms that have been around since the 90s. And I think the second generation of that is like the little tech thing. And those are the people, I don't think it's limited to little tech. I think it's all of tech kind of made that shift around 2023, 2024 to, and the way I describe it is like, it's like I said at the beginning, I call myself an anti-left Marxist. And I define left in a very, very concrete coalitional terms, right? Which is a coalition between the professional managerial class and the lumpen proletariat that's funded by tech, defense, pharma, and finance. And what we saw for the past 30 previous years was that finance was in the driver's seat of that coalition, right? With Barack Obama and Joe Biden being the senator from BNA, et cetera, et cetera. But what we saw more recently in the 2020s was kind of like a Chinese fire drill where, you know, instead of finance being in the driver's seat, we now have tech in the driver's seat. And instead of them driving the blue car, they're driving the red car. Fundamentally, the parties are fictions. They're vehicles to power. It's not like they're ideological constraints. They're just ballot lines for people to run on. So I think that's kind of what we're seeing is that when we did this kind of Chinese fire drill, the people who were really pushing for that switch from finance to tech were these more little tech, newer age people like the David Sachs, Mark Andreessen.
Mm-hmm. I guess another question, not to get too buried in the weeds here, but can you really disaggregate tech and finance? Because my understanding of these things is that a lot of Silicon Valley, a lot of these people, even Elon Musk, are built really on market cap valuation. and they're in a sense a creation of finance. Yeah. So I mean, how can big? I mean, if the money men really wanted, if the city and the likes of Larry Fink and BlackRock and all the asset firms and State Street and all of these different Vanguard, if they wanted to crash these people, they could, couldn't they? Could they not?
In a purely technical sense, yes. But because, like you said, they're so enmeshed with each other and they're part of this kind of coalition of capital together, it would be suicidal for them to do so. And in the same vein, defense tech is kind of completely enmeshed together at this point. As these coalitions kind of marinate together, they kind of become more and more enmeshed and become less and less separable. And in the exact same way, where it's like, NVIDIA is a tech company, but it's also like a financial scam at this point. Like, you know, it's kind of like a financial speculation thing at this point. It's hard to kind of divorce them from one another. And that's why their interests are so, you know, in alignment. And that's why they basically are all, everything that we react against, whether it's a given war, whether it's this given policy, whether it's, you know, migration, whether it's, you know, the vaccines, whether it's this or that or the other thing. Fundamentally, when you start digging back at it, it's like, oh yeah, you're going to start seeing tech companies, finance companies, pharma companies, and defense companies.
So given what their permanent interests are, why are they currently G-ing up what can only be described as white nationalist rhetoric and anti-immigration rhetoric in America and all around Europe? Why is Elon Musk attending Tommy Robinson rallies and telling people to go out and fight in the street and blah, blah, blah? Like, what are they up to? Because, I mean, clearly, if you look at their incentives, they're one of the big reasons that we get mass migration in the first place. It is right. The power of capital against organized labor, right? I mean, this is just classic 101 Marxism. So what are they actually up to, in your view?
My initial instinct is to say that whenever there's something cognizable in terms of a reaction or a message that comes out, immediately you'll start seeing their tentacles start to try to get into it in order to direct it, in order to neuter it, in order to feed off of that energy, right? So it can be anything. I mean, truly, you know, from where I stand in the market, I see out of the corner of my eye, you know, all these homo cons, these people who think of themselves as conservatives, who hate the trans issue, but are very vehement defenders of, you know, gay legal privileges like gay marriage and gay adoption, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And immediately, of course, you're going to see, once you start digging, it's like, oh, why is there a Clairvaux fellow there? Why is there a Clairvaux fellow at this thing? Well, so it's something about it is that as soon as there's anything cognizable that you're able to name and recognize as an entity, they're going to immediately want to have a foothold in it, right? Just because it allows you to, if need be, direct it in a way that kind of neuters its actual threat to your thing. And in the same way, it's like, think of Tommy Robinson as a perfect example, right? Tommy Robinson's attraction to a British person is about this kind of nativist, anti-immigration, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you just kind of analyze what Tommy Robinson's doing, it's like, well, he's all for Indian migration. He's all for non-British migration into the British Isles, so long as it's not Muslim. And then it goes back to the same thing as like why we're talking about the Somalis here, or why we're talking about Dearborn here, because it's like, it goes back to this broader question of like, oh, well, the threat, and I'm the first to say, Europe's issues with Islam and Muslims is different than America's. They have an actual demographic issue tied in with Islam that is different from America. But even in Europe, the issue is not that they're Muslim. The issue is that they're not European, right? Ayaan Hirsi Ali is not Dutch because she hates Islam. It doesn't matter if someone comes to Europe and she's a Reddit lib atheist or a Christian or whatever, she's not European. But someone like Tommy Robinson kind of captures that nativist energy and directs it into a way that's still is still conducive with, you know, tech's need for H. Well, I don't know what the equivalent of the British H-1B is, but that type of Indian tech influx of workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we call it the counter jihad. the counter jihad, right?
Yeah.
But if you have a look at what the counter jihad does, I mean, I had breakdowns of this many years ago. I had a video called The Tactical Bigotry of Containment, right? You want to talk about limited hangout. Some people just want an excuse, a permission to be racist for a bit, okay? And this issue, the counter jihad, gives people like their 2 minutes where they're allowed to be racist for a bit, okay? But if you actually have a look at the form that counter jihad takes, they end up basically defending the liberal order against that which is, you might say, reactionary or conservative in Islam, women's rights.
These Muslims don't respect our gay marriages.
Exactly this. So it ends up around the back door being like a defense of the liberal order.
around the back door.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Funnier than I realized. Right?
I couldn't help myself.
this is something that once you see it, you can't unsee it. One of the difficulties is, though, is that because you have this tendency that you talk about of whatever it is, they have to get in there. Regardless how obscure or how tiny they get in there, how do you stop people picking up those Fall for It Again awards? Brazilian thought.
And so for me, what I do is I really try to focus on certain concrete anti-left positions I will refuse to negotiate on, right? So for me, one of them is mass deportations, right? I can't, if you are making any type of excuse, any type of roundabout, oh, the H-1Bs, oh, this, sorry, you've made that's a clear delineation. Another one is censorship, and we'll talk about this in another conversation where, you know, a perfect example is, why is it that Peter Thiel is funding this small, insignificant art scene in Lower Manhattan in which they have a trans model in their man's magazine? Once you understand that censorship and the trans question is a delineating factor, you start to see like, oh, wait, actually, this is quite subversive. In your man's magazine, they're paying for a trans model to be in your magazine. So, So mass immigration, the trans question, which connects to censorship, is really the actual problem there. And then a full-throated critique of certain types of supremacism. And so once you have those three kind of guiding guardrails, you can start seeing like, okay, this seems like an insignificant little coalition of people, but it seems like they're getting a lot of attention. What is it here that's happening? And if it's one of those three kind of tripwires, you have to build an immune response to these types of crypto leftist incursions into your feed, basically.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing though, because there's certain types of people who just love the scene, right? The scene.
Yeah.
I'm antisocial, Brazilian, right? I hate the scene, right? I mean, another reason I hate the scene is because the scene is a gay club. But that's a different issue, right? But every, like, you know, enough drink, enough time, every right-wing scene becomes a gay club. Mm-hmm. But
I love it.
I've seen it happen in London, right? There's this kind of like, I say it's like when the arts hoes turn up. The arts hoes mm-hmm. turn up. And it's like, well, now the thing that we were talking about 5 years ago or 10 years ago, now it's about this thing. And this thing is not what we, like, this is a different thing. You see what I mean? But because somebody like me is just doesn't want to be part of that, it's going to happen. Someone like me says, like, right, I'm not being part of that thing. But then
and there's no control on it. There's no
then it becomes a thing. And the instincts of the people who are left in that thing aren't my instincts.
Right.
And so you can see how it, and I don't know what you do about this. It's just like, it just happens over and over again.
It's taking the New York City scene as to continue that example, right? I joined a little too late to be that counterbalancing force, but even while I was involved with it, I was very much in the space of like, oh no, I love for all of us to have fun and for it to be a scene, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, you should still be able to say with your whole chest those certain unmovable guideposts, right? So it's like, as long as I can say with my whole chest that, you know, gender identity expression shouldn't be recognized in law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I don't care who you have prancing around here in a wig and high heels. It's not my fucking business. I'm not a social conservative, right? I am anti-left. I hate this political coalition that wants to censor the discourse and flood the country with migrants and force you to get the jab, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, and but what happens is a lot of times, to take it back to the broader point, is in this media market, in order to advance our media, our take selling careers, it's important and it's very useful to brand yourself a certain way, right? My brand is very much like, you know, Dionysian hedonist, fat, gay, brown, whatever, whatever, whatever. It's very fun. But certain people with, you know, an uninteresting personality and nothing unique about them themselves kind of default to certain things where it's like, I'm a trad LARPer. I'm this. And it's like, okay, well, first of all, you're not. There's no such thing as a social conservative in America, in my personal opinion. But it's very funny when on the timeline you have to market your brand, your takes as being a trad conservative, you know, right wing, even bronze age, whatever. Meanwhile, we're all here at the same scene and we're all, you know, taking toasts with the guy in the dress. It's like, for me, it doesn't conflict with my brand. For you, it does, and it ends up compromising something for you, and you end up having to compromise yourself in the process.
Very interesting indeed. Well, I mean, there's so much more we can talk about, and we will do in some subsequent videos, but for now, this was a good taster of Bazillion thought in general. Where can people find you again?
So, yeah, I'm on Twitter, at Bazillion Thought, and YouTube, at The Betty Basil Show.
You're thinking about like what's my brand, what's my USP? I'm just see, this is the thing,
crotchety academic.
But that's just who I am. I'm like this.
Authenticity is the best branding, and I also just a brown hedonist faggot, whatever. So I mean, it's branding is.
It's another always, bleep, Bazillion.
Sorry. But, you know, branding is always best when it's true to who you are. So does it feel like an exercise in branding? It just feels like an exercise in expression.
Exactly, yeah. I suppose. I just miss the days where you didn't even have to think about it. You just...
Oh, you got to get with the times, old man. You got to sell yourself in the market.
My gosh. Speaking of which, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, Trivium, the bestseller there. And I'll catch you next time. Get out, everybody. If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.